Hello and welcome to episode 172 of the official EstablishTheRun.com podcast. My name is Adam Levitan, and today we have a genuinely special guest making his second appearance on the show. Is a young man playing the actual highest stakes in the world, not the fake highest stakes like DFS or poker, the actual highest stakes game in the world, which is the options in the United States stock market, is of course Jason Strasser. Jason, how's it going, buddy?
Oh man, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I guess maybe I shouldn't say that without knowing. Do you think the options market and the U.S. stock market is actually the highest stakes game in the world?
It's not, but it's up there. It's like, it's, let's just see. There's probably something like, let's call it $5 to $10 billion of money made in this market every year from like professionals. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot bigger than DFS or poker, sure. But there are markets out there that are way bigger than that. And I'm not pretending that like, I have a very big market share of that $5 to $10 billion, but that gives you some idea of what we're talking about.
Sure. Okay. If you listened to episode 69 with Jason, I hope you learned a lot. If you didn't, I think you highly, highly recommend you check out episode 69. We went through a little bit of Jason's background there, so we're not going to get into that today. The reason I wanted to have him back on here, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months later, was because, I mean, my God, Jason, things have gotten absolutely out of control on our beloved internet. The stock market is out of control. Crypto is out of control. The NFT space is out of control. DeFi is out of control. Everything is out of control. I mean, if you just took some money out of your pocket around the last time we talked, threw it blindly out the window, and anything that it hit, I mean, you printed money. And so I think that Jason is very good at parsing what's real, what's fake, what's sustainable, what's not, what's really happening. So I wanted to have him back. So I want to start with this. I've heard this take over and over again since this whole thing started last March. This is going to end badly for everyone. You know, they said the retail bros are going to get wrecked. They said, you know, the Wall Street and the finance people, they all said, oh, this is going to end so badly. These people don't know what they're doing. They're all going to get wrecked. And honestly, maybe that is still how it will end. But at this point, you have to say that these people who allegedly didn't know what they're doing are up massively. I mean, basically anyone who invested, quote unquote, invested anything in the last 10 months is crushing. So what is the take now as we sit here in March?
I think, first of all, we're going to talk about some stuff. I have an idea what the hell's going on, and some other stuff I have no idea what the hell's going on, like the crypto and the stuff I'm a fish at. But I'm happy to be on here talking about all of it. I think if you go back to last year, retail, like when I was on the pod last, people were buying, doing all the right things. Like professionals were panicking and selling stocks while retail people were getting their stimulus checks and were sitting at home and were buying stocks. And I think you have to sort of, you have to break the last year out into like phases. So the first phase, the market pukes. Bitcoin 3000, you know, market way down, the down 11% one day. Retail was doing all the right things. Like all the data show that retail was buying and professionals were selling. And so it's not that common if you go throughout the course of history where it kind of works out like that, especially big market corrections. Usually it's retail panicking and selling. This time they were doing all the right things. And like you said, like you just buy anything at work. Like you don't have to fucking know anything. Mm-hmm. Then you got this big recovery, and then you started seeing some, what I would classify as some like crazier type of things starting to happen. So the first thing was some of these like solar and, you know, obviously Bitcoin crypto, and around the time of the election, you know, Cathie Wood, I don't know if you followed her stuff, but she runs investment, you know, she invests in a lot of high growth, like pie in the sky type of Tesla type of things. And that kind of went totally bananas. And that really kind of surprised people, I thought. The recovery made a lot of sense, right? Because COVID, people were worried about it being a lot worse than it ended up being in terms of for the market. And it looks like we're going to, knock on wood, get back to some sort of normalcy pretty soon. But then, yeah, the solar stuff started taking off and the pot stocks started taking off. And a lot of like, kind of like stuff that like, this might end badly. That's the first phase, was like smart stuff happening. The second one, kind of more up in the air, right? And then it kind of went on to the AMC, GME, Nokia, that thing. And that was way different. That was like, okay, fuck the shorts. You know, let's find these highly shorted stocks and let's go nuts, right? that was a totally different beast. Like that wasn't, that was just like a very, yeah. I mean, no one's ever seen anything like that. So, and that, and we know how that mostly ended. I mean, look at most of that. I mean, the net is a loss. Like GameStop, they're up probably, but like pretty much everything else was a loss. Mm-hmm. And net, I'm pretty convinced that did not turn out well. So we know how that ended. But yeah, it's been a really fascinating like last year. The last year feels like 10 years to me. It really feels like I talked to you 10 years ago, honestly. but I would say the stuff with Wall Street Bets, and I went on, not to give another podcast a shout out, but I did a BA podcast on just on GameStop. And we could spend a lot of time talking about it, but GameStop was like a great trade. Like it was a well-executed short squeeze. And whether they were fish or pros or whatever, they got it right. And then they tried the same thing with other things like Nokia and AMC and Silver and Rocket Mortgage and whatever. And all of that stuff didn't work. It was like they had a good hand. They played it great. And they tried the same strategy in other spots and it didn't work. And that's the summary of what happened with that.
Yeah. I think I tweeted at the time that people should listen to Jason on BA's podcast about the GameStop thing. I do have a few more questions about the GameStop thing, which I want to get to in a minute here. I'm curious, though, more at a higher level, if you really actually think there's a paradigm shift here, if there's an actual shift where the online culture, quote unquote, like the internet wins, momentum trading wins. And by that, I mean, like, look, the internet is obsessed with Elon Musk. The internet is obsessed with Portnoy. And I get, you know, people are just going to blindly fire, regardless of all this other stuff that you mentioned. I'm set aside weird things like GameStop and AMC and Nokia. People are going to blindly fire at Tesla and at Penn because they like Elon and they like Portnoy. They're like, fuck the fundamentals. Like, this is the internet, baby. And even something like Doge, which I don't know how closely you followed the Dogecoin thing, like a literal meme. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. If the internet gets behind it, it can pump at least in the short term. So do you think there's an actual paradigm shift here where internet culture has actually changed what's going on in markets?
It certainly had its moment. The one thing Bloomberg ran an article today talking about retail trading. It's the last 2 weeks has fallen off a cliff. And I think if you go back like 3 or 4 months ago, there were like a lot of people saying like, this is a new paradigm shift. Retail traders here to stay. All I can tell you, I have no idea. All I can tell you is what I see in the market, which is that in the last 2 weeks, it's really, really quieted down. So maybe we're, whatever was happening in January and February, that can't be like a permanent thing. Now, whether there's always going to be stocks in the market there like Tesla and Penn that have fanboys and fangirls going nuts about them. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that really monitors is activity is like, are people going to care about this shit when the world gets back to normal? Like when you're able to travel and you're able to spend money on other stuff, I really do think my bet is that you're going to see the sort of what you saw the last 2 weeks when the world started to open up in certain places and the interest sort of die down. Robinhood's not in the top 100 on the Apple Store anymore. I would love to see interest in markets continue, but like it was a crazy mania. I don't see it like that going forward. And I think you will see fanboy and fangirl stocks forever, but I don't think you're going to see what we saw in January and February go on for very long.
Yeah, it was so unique, I think. Not only were people stuck at home, stuck in front of their computer, but they weren't, I mean, what did people do? They go out, they party, they drink, they do drugs, they go on vacations. They weren't doing any of that. You know what I mean? Right. They had all this money to fire and they were in front of their computer the whole time. So, I mean, yeah, it was certainly a unique situation. Yeah.
It's hard to see this go. It's hard to see whatever that going on forever. I mean, it's hard to see. Like that.
Yeah. Okay. One thing I do like about this whole thing that happened, and again, I don't know how it ends. You know, we have some idea how it's going to end. But one thing that I do like is that it was kind of a bit of a fuck you to Wall Street and corporate, and not in the sense about money. Like, you know, some people are like, fuck you, these guys shouldn't be making so much money. I couldn't care less about that. I'm happy for them. It's to me more about the arrogance that only guys in suits with MBAs from Wharton and Harvard can gamble on the stock market. Like only these people can do it. I mean, that is just a ridiculous notion to me. And at least this whole episode proved that, hey, anybody can at least get in there and mix it up. It might work out. It might not. But like, listen, like we're out there gambling. We have an agreed upon set of rules. I can research a stock. I can build a model. I can do whatever I can do, just like I would in poker or DFS or sports betting, and try to make the best decision I can. And at least let me get in there and gamble and don't say, you can't do this. You didn't go to you didn't go to Harvard for business school or whatever. So at least that was something good for me. I tried to tweet something like that to try to make this point that, you know, it was all kind of gambling and, you know, it's all in the same genre. There's rules that we agree upon. I try to be better than somebody else at it. The difference is that, you know, many people push back on was, well, that's true. In DFS and poker and sports betting, the rake is just so, so hard to overcome. In stocks, you know, the market in theory goes up 8% every year. Not only are you not paying rake, but you are playing a very positive sum game. So I get that. But at least in the very least, it was like, hey, listen, anybody can get in there and mix it up. I thought that was at least a good thing. Do you follow what I'm saying great. At all?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely. Like, here's what I don't like about this whole thing is that there's a culture that, I started my career and then 2008 happened. And I feel like that's like fucked me up a little bit. Like I started it off and everything exploded, like literally financial system to its knees. And I feel like that prevented me from doing some good investments later in my life where I was just very cautious just by nature. And I think part of that environment I grew up in, the kids these days, and by kids, I don't mean like actual kids, but some of them actual kids, but like the Robin Hooders these days, they just love the pump. There's something about it. You know, they don't even give a shit what it is. And the thing I don't like about them is that they're lazy. Like, it's just lazy. Like, it's just easy to be like, oh, GME's at 200. Yeah, I'm part of this. I'm jumping in. I just like not that impressive to me. It's like, I wish people were out there doing research, finding cool stocks, whether they do fundamentals or technicals, or momentum. All right, cool. Like, have a strategy, try to make money. Some of this stuff's lazy. Let's just be honest. Like, it's just like people that don't do any work. Oh, he tweeted out Dogecoin. I'm going to buy it. Like, it's lazy. And like, I think I'm a big fan of people getting interested in markets, but I sort of think a lot of it's like lazy, half-assed bullshit. Whereas there's not as much real work being done by some of these people, in my opinion.
Yeah. We had a couple of questions from people, from Andreas and from Jake. Basically, their question was, has a massive influx of retail traders influenced your approach? If so, how? And from Jake, what changes have you made to your investment process over the last 12 months? I know you can't get into specifics about how you trade and stuff like that, but any general answers for these guys? Have you personally had to change how you trade and invest throughout these last 12 months?
1,000%. I mean, if you're doing what I'm doing and you're not paying attention to what's going on in the message boards, you're doing it wrong. What I will say though is like it's really easy to keep track of what's going on. Like there's this idea that like it's like hard to follow what's going on, or like they caught a lot of people off guard on Wall Street Bets, especially the GME thing. Like people were not aware. It's like the easiest adjustment ever though to follow what's going on there. You can get these like third party apps that like give you a list of everything trending. It's not rocket science. Like I said, like GME was the perfect storm, but like it's hard to imagine like that happening again, because A, it's very easy to follow Wall Street Bets. And yeah, it's definitely changed our thing. We also like, because a lot of the people that are like following these trades on Wall Street Bets, they're not very price sensitive. So they'll just like do whatever everyone else is doing. Of course, that creates like some dislocations in pricing. So there are a lot more opportunities like that out there than normal. It'd just be like if everyone, like if Dave Portnoy tweeted out like a college basketball game pick or something and everyone just plowed into it, like the right move is probably taking the other side of that or whatever, right? So it's kind of the same thing in my world. Like if you see something extreme like that, you're probably supposed to take the other side of it.
Sure. Okay. I want to get into this Robinhood saga for a second, because I'm sure a lot of people listening had Robinhood accounts, were involved in the whole saga. I don't want to rehash the whole thing, but basically, as Jason mentioned, you know, heavily shorted stocks such as GameStop were kind of pumped by Reddit / the internet, to the point that, I mean, from what I could tell, very rich people got liquidated or were about 100%. To get liquidated. Yeah. And then, well, you know, maybe I should let you explain what happened after when they were about to get liquidated and the whole thing got all messed up and turned off. I guess you should probably explain exactly what happened, why Robinhood had to turn it off.
Yeah, first of all, it's like super sad how it all played out. Like it was bullshit. Like it was going to end. It should not have ended like this, if you know what I'm saying. Like it didn't feel right to anyone. Basically, if you believe Robinhood, what they say, and I do believe what Robinhood is saying. So in the U.S., when you trade a stock, there's T+2 settlement, which all that means is you buy the stock for $100, you don't actually pay for it for 2 days. So the exchange, the reason we have exchanges, stock exchanges or option exchanges, is so that when Adam, you go buy a stock, you don't have to worry about someone delivering it. Or when you sell a stock, you don't have to worry about getting paid, right? We need a middleman. Like in the old days, when you traded, it was always counterparty risk and it slows things down. And no one wants to deal with that shit. You want to sell your stock and get your money and not worry about it. That's why exchanges exist. But what exchanges do is they monitor all the counterparties on the exchange and they say, can they make good on this payment? Can they make good on this payment? They have different tests. So effectively, when GME went to the moon and Robinhood was trading billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars of this thing, the exchanges went to, the clearinghouses went to Robinhood and said, hey, look at all this activity. Are you going to be money good in T+2? Because this is a lot more than normal, like way, 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 way more than normal. You guys need to put up more cash. Robinhood didn't have the cash. And like you saw that they ended up raising the money to try to like, and they raised quite a bit of money like the last second, but they had to slow down transactions. So they basically stopped the kind of orders that would increase the amount of money they have to post as collateral. So they basically were closing only. Like you couldn't buy more, you could only sell. Yeah, screwed up. I think it's a failure in Robinhood and they should have planned for this. I get what they're saying. It was hard to see something like this happening, but they weren't ready.
Why not turn off signups? Why not turn off the sell side?
Yeah, exactly.
Also?
Why aren't you turning off signups? Yeah. That's the best point ever. Do the top shot thing, right? Turn off the signups. If you're overwhelmed, there are things you can do without. Yeah, it's nonsense. I agree with you. I mean, it got out of control real quick, but they were not on top of it.
And I don't know if this is allowed. I mean, they turned off the buy side. Like, why couldn't you turn off the sell side also?
I feel like that would also be like really sad too. Like I'm not a fan of that. I heard that argument from Portnoy. I heavily disagree with that. I don't think you want to turn off the sell side. I think like you want to allow customers to trade as much as they can. If you're handcuffed in some way, limit the activity like the least you have to. I think telling someone, hey, you have a stock and you can't sell it is even worse than saying, hey, you can't buy more. Yeah. But yeah, it was really unfortunate and really sad, but there was a round two for GameStop. So I guess people maybe got their moment a second time.
Okay. Zooming out on Robinhood, in the wake of all this, Robinhood came under a lot of criticism and, you know, there were all these theories about Robinhood and Citadel's relationship. Citadel was the one, I guess you would say, actually making the trades, or they were sending, Robinhood was sending the trades to Citadel, or however you would describe it. Robinhood is saying that their customers are still getting the best price on a trade. Is that true? And I know we went through this last time about how Robinhood makes money and everything, but can you still say that people using Robinhood and other apps like this are getting the best price possible?
It's a very complicated question. And what I would encourage everyone to do is if you just put into Google, like Robinhood form 606, you can see exactly what Robinhood is getting paid by who. So you'll see like Citadel is number one, you'll see like other counterparties. And you'll notice, the first thing you'll notice if you look at it is you see that the money Robinhood's making from stocks is actually way smaller than they're making from options. So the real money maker in this payment for order flow business is options. But let's back up. So what's happening, when you're a market maker, one of the big risks you have when you show a bidder an offer is that there's a big fund that's trying to buy a lot. Because then you sell, and then you sell, and then you sell, and then you sell, and you get run over. Mm-hmm. And so market makers have to expect that to happen some of the time. So they have to price their quotes a certain way. The argument for payment for order flow is that for retail money, it's small and it's dumb, in their opinion. Okay, so it's small and it's dumb. So they can treat it friendlier than they can treat normal orders because it's small and it's dumb. Now, the part that no one ever talks about is that Robinhood is the one that has the biggest effect on pricing, because Robinhood tells Citadel, every option I send you that you get to control where it goes, you pay me half a penny, mm-hmm, or whatever the number is. That amount of money is directly related to how Citadel will quote that order. So let's just say instead of Citadel getting charged half a penny, they get charged a tenth of a penny. Citadel would get better, you get better pricing for your customers. Mm-hmm. So combination, right? One is Robinhood dictates the pricing of where their order flow gets priced, which has an effect on your execution prices. And the second one is wherever Citadel and the other guys are sort of pricing this stuff. I think it's a decent system. There's a lot of pros and cons. The big thing I don't like about it is it's very opaque. I personally would rather have a broker where I pay them money, a commission, to go find the best execution for me in the market. So like if you go open up Interactive Brokers account, most or all of their execution is like that. You pay commission and they go and they try to get the best price in the market for you. That's more transparent than what this payment for order flow. And I think what people are really pissed off about is that it doesn't feel right. It just feels wrong. Then of course you have Citadel, like a different arm of Citadel, like bailing out this hedge fund and GME. I don't think there was any scandal there. Some of the conspiracy theories, they have like a 1 in 100,000 chance of happening that way. But it still didn't, it just didn't feel right. I don't think payment for order flow is necessarily a bad thing. I think it's kind of a very opaque thing. I think people like Robinhood need to be more transparent about it. But it's not like an evil thing happening.
Well, I would say that if people are only buying, I don't know, $500 worth of stock or $1,000 worth of stock, can you really afford to pay $10 or $20 per trade in commission to find the best price for that? You know what I mean?
It should be like some sort of penny or two per share. So like the old way of doing those orders was by like one trade is $15. That would obviously be completely ridiculous.
Right.
But like I was saying, like, let's just say Citadel is being charged X dollars per share for an order. You could instead just pay that commission directly to a broker and have them go find the best price in the market. The thing about Robinhood is you're paying commission. You just don't feel it. Like it's just built into the price of your execution. And that feels a little bit less transparent, but like the economics should be very, very similar between the two.
Sure. Okay. Let's move to Bitcoin and crypto. I want to be clear here. Jason was a no coiner. I mean, how embarrassing, Jason. A no coiner. However, now he's.
I would say very, very low coiner. Yeah, very low coiner.
So now, Bo, I'm in this punks chat with like the richest people on earth, including Jason, and he is a punker. He's in the DeFi streets, and I want to get into that. But I just looking back on this BTC run, I think like the common thing that people would say in Bitcoin would be like, oh, it was inevitable, right? In the end, it was inevitable. Was it really, looking back, even with knowing everything we know now, was it really inevitable in your opinion? And how did you become a no-coiner? And I guess people want to know why you were a no-coiner.
Well, I goofed up. So I learned about Bitcoin when it was like $30 or something like that. It was explained to me as like payments of the future. Like you're going to go to Starbucks, you're going to use your Bitcoin and buy it. And I did some research and I was like, there's no way. Like there's just no way. And me being like a stubborn idiot, like I held on to that. And what ended up happening was the thesis changed. Like today, nobody says that. Nobody thinks you're going to go buy a pizza with Bitcoin. That used to be the thesis back in like 10 years ago. And the thesis changed to digital gold. And I saw that happening and I should have reacted. I bought a little bit. I've had like little bits of Bitcoin, but like less than 2% of my net worth for like a long time. And yeah, I missed it. I don't know how to say it. Like the thesis changed on Bitcoin. I was not a believer. So I missed the first like $30 to $5,000 one. And then the thesis changed, right? It went to digital gold. And like, listen, Bitcoin has just it's made itself legit, right? And now it's an alternative asset class. And now you're going to get like widespread adoption. The price of Bitcoin is impossible to predict though. Like you can make very clear arguments for it to be worth like a million of Bitcoin, right? Like there's a finite supply, a third of them are lost. Like it's designed to go up. Like it's the supply and demand dynamics behind it. So I have a very hard time like telling anyone what the right price for Bitcoin is. I think anyone that says they know the right price for it is full of shit. It's all about just like whether this adoption continues or whether this is kind of a fad. And like, yeah, okay, like one software company went nuts and Tesla bought a few, but it doesn't actually turn into a real thing. But yeah, it seems by all accounts, like we have a new asset class. It's digital gold. is what it is. But looking back on it, honestly, like, it wasn't super clear to me that we were going to get that jump from this payments thing that I knew was busted to this new asset class. But we're there now.
Yeah, I would say, shifting it to your world, it seems to me like that places like Goldman and JP Morgan or whatever, they're not actually, from what I can tell, they're not actually investing in Bitcoin themselves, but they're making it available to their customers. If their customers come to them and say, I want to buy some Bitcoin or whatever, Goldman will facilitate that for you or whatever. Or am I misreading that? Like, what's going on Wall Street in Bitcoin?
It's still early. I can't buy Bitcoin in my fund right now. Like, first of all, I couldn't legally, but let's just say I could. My prime broker won't do that. And I don't think any prime brokers on Wall Street allow that. It's still like a big problem, custody. Like, that's the biggest thing. Like, when I invest for my investors, I never worry about security. Like, I never worry, like, is the stock going to go get hacked and stolen or whatever. And that's the thing about crypto, is like, it's a real risk. And if someone goofs up, you'll lose them, or there's ways you can, you know, whatever. And like, I think Coinbase charges like 1% a year to custody the Bitcoin. It feels kind of gross. Mm-hmm. I think that's the next step. And it's still very, very early. Like, almost no real money owns Bitcoin, in my opinion. It's just starting. So, but yeah, the main barrier to that has been security, in my opinion. And certain investors, like, don't want to deal with that kind of shit. They don't want to, like, it's not practical. They need to make it, like, so easy to buy Bitcoin where you don't need, like you can call up your Goldman. Goldman will buy it for you, keep it in your account, and they'll deal with the security risks of it. It's not set up for that yet. I think there's a trading desk on Goldman, but I'm 99% sure their prime broker business, which is the business that like funds will use, will not custody them for you.
Okay. So now you've gone from someone who mostly missed the Bitcoin run to being in punks and being in DeFi. I mean, how does this happen? How do you go from BTC to being in punks?
All right, let's talk about the DeFi stuff. First of all, I'm not like big in DeFi. But I call it as like a DeFi exploration. I've been exploring DeFi. It's interesting to me, and I've been spending like the last month all my free time like learning more about DeFi. I wouldn't say like we're gonna get into it later, but like, let's put that aside. Punks. I think I started with punks the same way everyone starts with punks, which is like, what the fuck is this? This is stupid. Like, the same way, honestly, Top Shot, like any one of these NFTs, like the first reaction I had is like, come on, right? But I was looking at the entire NFT space, and I was dividing into like three categories. There was the collectibles. So punks, Top Shots, So Rare. Those are like the main big ones that were hash mass or whatever.
Hash mass, yeah.
Yeah, there's some other ones. But those are like those kind of the group, right? And then there was the art and music. I throw the music in there too, but mostly art, you know, like, you know, whatever, Beeple and on down. And then the third category is like complete garbage. So like, you know, Logan Paul, like turning his unboxing into an NFT and people turning tweets into NFTs and just complete garbage. So they're like three categories of NFTs for me. And so when I was looking at them, like a lot of them were falling into the third bucket. Like a lot of them just seemed like garbage. The art stuff, I struggle with, because you want to like, it's all artist-based, obviously. You want to get the artist that gets popular or whatever. The problem with the art in this space versus other art is that these guys make like one of these things a day, or like one, like Phoosis and Beeple and all these guys, they make like a shit ton of art. And a lot of them are young. Right. You think about art. The main thing about art is like that everyone's dead. Right. So there's just like the supply and demand dynamics are much better in art. Like, forget like whether you like it on your wall or like it on your computer. And I think there's going to be a lot of cool ways of displaying art. But the supply and demand dynamics in the art market, I mean, especially when you talk about the prices you see people trading some of the stuff at. I mean, you can buy an Andy Warhol signed print for 30 grand today. And he's dead, and this is a finite number of them. And that's the thing that worries me. If you just look at like the volume of art coming through and the amount of art these guys are going to produce, just like take their average selling price now and say one a week for the next 10 years, that's a lot of fucking money and a lot of art. So that's the problem I have with the art market is like, I don't mean this in a morbid way. If one of these guys drop dead, like, I'm in. And I'm sorry. Like, I'm not rooting for it, but I'm just explaining how I think about it. The music stuff's kind of cool. It's like a Euler Beats, and they're it's very much like what I thought it was 3LAU, but I learned now.
Yeah, me too.
I haven't listened to him, but I got to check it out. But like what he did is pretty cool. Like selling like an experience, like, hey, you cash this token in, I'll make you an album. You can like help me make an album or whatever. Like, I thought that was pretty cool. And I think the music industry has a lot of cool things that can happen with this. But as far as investing, like I don't know how to like invest in the music stuff. So that I threw that aside. Now the collectibles, again, it comes down to supply and demand. And that's why punks are cool in my opinion. Like there's 10,000, there's probably 2,000 that are lost. Like if you look at the wallets, there's like a bunch of wallets that have not touched these things in 4 years. And if you think about the kind of person that would claim a punk in 2017, probably not a billionaire. And they probably would not be sitting on a wallet worth like tens of millions of dollars and not doing anything. So there's 10,000 punks and like 2,000 lost. I don't think they're the most cool thing in the world, but if NFTs are going to work, like this is the one, in my opinion. It's the rookie card of NFTs. And so like the way I look at it too is like, it's kind of like Ethereum exposure. Like it's like crazy Ethereum exposure. And I think they're very reasonable. I think they make a lot of sense. My regret with the punks is that I bought pieces of a lot of like lower end punks. And definitely if I could go back a month, I would have done that with middle tier punks, because I think the floor is a little bit, there's less value on the floor and there's a lot more value in the middle to upper punks.
Sure. So, yeah. I love punks too. And I just thought, hey, I think NFTs are going to win. I don't know exactly which one, but if you just want to bet on NFTs winning as a whole, it seems like punks will move with the NFT market up or down.
Yeah,
no matter how
it's safer. And Top Shots, Top Shots also has a supply and demand problem. Like if the thing about Top Shots, when you look at it, is like, you know, a shit ton of this stuff's overvalued, like no matter what, like there's just way too many commons. And like, okay, the stuff that like, I think Bales, maybe you guys were buying that, like, you know, Ja Morant, rookie, first one. Mm-hmm. Okay, that I get. But like, there's a lot of like really expensive, like Luka All-Star Game one, like going for $1,000 plus. Like if you look at playing cards and you kind of draw the parallels to Top Shot, there's a lot of stuff that's overvalued. And yeah, so like for me, like if I compare Top Shots and punks, it's like a no-brainer. For someone like me that's casual, you can just buy a few punks, and if it goes bananas, you'll have something super valuable. That's what I think makes more sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we got some questions. They want your take, is Top Shot dead and everything like that. I think it's fair though, what you said. And yeah, the thesis the whole time on the Top Shot stuff was LeBron, Zion, rookie cards, S1. It was never that my Domantas Sabonis MGLE was going to be worth $4,000. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Well, you should see our office right now. When there's a pack drop, the whole office stops and goes in the pack line, and everyone's just trying to flip the pack. You know, it's obviously like this phenomenon right now. If you just do some very basic math, it feels like it's got to cool off. But I really do like the rare Top Shots. Like, I think this has a chance of like being like when you look back, if NFTs take us off, this is going to be one of the first ones.
Yeah.
And it's cool.
And I mean, Dapper and Top Shot has such a huge, huge, huge head start and huge market share. They're raising so much money. And so, I mean, they, you know, people who say, oh, there's going to be competitors to Top Shot, maybe, but I mean, Dapper has such a huge head start.
The best thing about Top Shot is that you're on the blockchain, but you don't even know it. Like, the average Joe is on it. Think about like this DeFi crap, like the amount of crap you, you're in a science experiment in DeFi, whereas Top Shot, like, people don't know they're on the blockchain.
Exactly.
That's part about Top Shot.
Yeah, that was, I totally agree. And you're able to deposit with a US credit card and everything. People don't even need to go buy Ethereum or anything like that. I mean,
yeah,
they've made it seamless for people for sure.
And yeah, I mean, so cool. So
from
cool.
a customer acquisition perspective, I mean, I've never seen anything like the ability of Top Shot to acquire customers, 200, 400, 500,000 customers in 2 to 3 months. I mean, it's just absolutely
with no marketing,
insane.
Right? Yeah. Basically no marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, just like internet marketing. Yeah, I mean, just people talking about it. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Okay. I bet a lot of people listening to this don't even know what DeFi is.
Okay.
Because for a lot of reasons, I mean, A, you have to have crypto. Okay. So that eliminates some people right off the bat. B, even people who have crypto, probably like I would say 95% of the people who have crypto don't even know what DeFi is. However, the sharpest, the biggest players in the game, the people moving markets now, I think, in crypto, are all in the DeFi space now. How would you explain, like, to a layman what DeFi is right now?
Sure. So first of all, I'm a DeFi newbie, but I have spent a lot of time. And the one thing I can add is a little perspective, because I'm in, like, what do they call CeFi? I'm in, like, centralized finance. That's the world I'm in. Okay. There are two main things that are happening in DeFi now that have really gotten a lot of traction. The first is, like, lending and borrowing. So that's the thing that I learned about DeFi, is that you don't even need to, like, be involved in Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency. You can get involved in DeFi with dollars. So you can go on to, like, Aave or whatever, and you can lend your basic dollars. You know, they could be called Tether, USDC, whatever. You can lend your dollars and get back a return for it. The thing about DeFi that I learned is that the market is basically long crypto, so long Bitcoin and Ethereum, and people are trying to use that as collateral to borrow other things, whether it's dollars. And a lot of what happens in DeFi, you need dollars to participate, and you need other, like, random shit coins or whatever coins you want to call them. So the main thing that's happening is there's a bunch of Ethereum and Bitcoin sitting there as collateral and people borrowing against them. That's the number one thing that's happening in DeFi. And it's pretty awesome. Like, anyone that's gone through the process of getting a home loan or, like, getting a line of credit from a bank, like, this shit is awesome. You just put your Bitcoin and you borrow. And they, if you get a margin call, they have protocols to take care of it. It's like, it's awesome. Like, yeah. And Haralabas has talked about how it's so much easier. Like, the borrowing and lending stuff going on is amazing. And honestly, like, even if you don't know anything about crypto, you should figure out a way to get your dollars that are sitting in your checking account getting 0.01% interest onto this thing, because these are established platforms. You can even diversify across lots of platforms, lend out your dollars, get 12 to 20% back on your dollars. I mean, how good is that?
I'd say two things. First, like, I'm going through the process of a home loan right now. I mean, they are up my ass. You know what I mean? I would love for it to be way more frictionless. And what you talked about before with counterparty risk, I don't know if there's counterparty risk in DeFi, but at least there's no middleman situation, like all this T+2.
There's contract risk in DeFi, right? There's contract risk, where it's like someone could find a hack or an exploit, right? But some of these protocols have $5 billion or whatever that are in them right now, and they haven't been hacked in a while. It's a pretty safe bet, especially if you spread around across them. So that's the coolest thing that's happening. It's nothing like that complicated, but it's awesome. The second thing are these things called decentralized exchanges, DEXs. And that's basically like trading without a centralized counterparty. And this really cool idea called AMM, which is automated market maker, came up. And, you know, there was a complicated problem, right? Like, how do we do decentralized trading without the normal way we do it, which is like streaming quotes? So you have an automated market maker like Citadel streaming all these quotes. How do we do trading without that? Because everyone knows how expensive like Ethereum is, for example. Imagine if someone had to stream quotes in Ethereum, it would just be like, it doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. So how does it work? Well, they came up with this really cool, it sounds really stupid, but there's like constant product market making, there's other variations of it, but basically create a pool of liquidity that acts as a market maker, where yes, the pool will get arbed because the pool is like just reacting to flow and not reacting to like a posted price somewhere. But you know, if you're collecting 30 basis points on each trade of Edge, in the long run, you can make money. And like Uniswap is the biggest one of those. And then, you know, my opinion on the DEXs is that we're very early on that stuff. Like, it's not a great experience trading on those things. If you compare trading on FTX or trading on Coinbase Pro or whatever to trading on these things, it's not the greatest experience. You send in an order, especially if it's on, you know, like Ethereum network, you send in an order, it costs like $50 to $100, which is ridiculous, right? And then you don't even get like a fill right away. Like, it kind of goes, I'm not an expert, but like it goes into outer space. And then like, sometimes it doesn't even work. And sometimes it comes back. It's like a early version of what could be cool one day. It's not there right now. And like, you see Uniswap put out something yesterday about like their V3, like their new updates. And like, so anyway, the other thing that's happening in DeFi is like Ethereum is clogged, right? And they're working on solutions, but Ethereum is like, anyone that's been on Ethereum, it's like super frustrating. It's like 3x a wire fee. It's like so stupid. We're getting crypto to avoid wire fees, right? So people are just copying the things that are working on the Ethereum network on other chains. So Binance Smart Chain, Solana, what's the stupid one? Oh, Terra. There are all these different blockchains. And unfortunately, like, there is a lot of innovation going on. There's also a lot of people that just are copying successful things on other platforms. So like SushiSwap copied Uniswap and made one little tweak where instead of just there's a coin reward to staking. And then PancakeSwap was on Binance Smart Chain, copied SushiSwap. And like, it's not like as full of innovation as it looks, because like half the damn things are just copying things that work on Ethereum to other chains, because every chain needs its own little ecosystem. But yeah, that on a high level, that's what's going on. Those are the two main successful things. There's also like derivatives and some other things going on and futures. But I think it's like a really cool science experiment. But what I will say is that you know, remember the ICO craze where everyone was getting on ICOs and hoping that would help? This is very similar to that. It has a different, some of the scams running on these places, you know, they offer you, hey, pool dollars and my shitcoin into this pool, and I'll give you like a ton of shitcoin in reward for doing this, right? What's the difference between that and like one of these ICO scams? Like, basically, all that ends up happening when you pool your money in one of these scams is somebody just sells a bunch of these coins and you lose all your money. So there's a lot of scams going on. And I feel like some people think like the farming is the same thing as creating a shitty ICO and just dumping it the minute people start buying it. And so,
yeah, along those lines, I know you tweeted that you were surprised, I guess, when you first found this or when you looked into this, that crypto includes a lot of leverage, right? Like,
oh my
gosh,
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't know what percent of the DeFi is basically collateralized by someone's Bitcoin position, but it feels to me like a ton of the liquidity coming in and out, people have their Bitcoin, they don't want to sell them, they post them up somewhere, and they're using that as a credit line. And a ton of what's going on in DeFi is like that. And it makes sense, but it was just shocking to me how much of that was happening.
Okay, so if you're shocked by that, that sounds kind of dangerous to me. Is it distorting the markets at all by all these people getting all this leverage? And I don't mean a lot of people in terms of number of people. I mean in the amount of the dollars that are being leveraged in DeFi.
Yeah, it's not like super yeah. Okay, if we saw like a big Bitcoin correction or big Ethereum correction, like not like what we saw today, like a real one, like, you know, drop 40% in a day. Mm-hmm. I do think that the rise of DeFi, there's a lot more margin Bitcoin and margin Ethereum out there. We haven't seen anything like that since, DeFi is so new, right? Like this stuff a year ago wasn't even a topic, right? It just was starting. And so, yeah, I think what we need to see is the next time we get a real sharp correction, whether we see the DeFi market like really take a hit as people get margin called on their Bitcoin and Ethereum.
You mentioned how you can get these outrageous APYs or whatever in DeFi, and you know, at your bank, you get almost nothing. Do you consider this, I mean, obviously not in the near term, but in the long term, an actual threat to standard banking? Like, will this actually become an important part of future financial markets?
It's so early. It's like in the science experiment phase. Like, we're so early with this stuff. The one thing I wish that we saw more in DeFi and in crypto in general are people that were like top shots, like where they make it so the average Joe can participate. Like, so much of this DeFi shit, it's like unreal how complicated it is. Mm-hmm. I hope the next wave of development are applications and projects that are geared just like top shots, where like random people can participate. And I unfortunately, like for whatever reason, maybe we're just very early, so we're like building the backbone, and eventually there will be a lot of stuff like that. But I don't know. I feel like it's very, 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 very early. But yeah, the lending stuff is pretty cool. The trading stuff, like, yeah, it's cool to be like, yeah, I traded decentralized, cool. But like, it's not a good experience. It's total garbage. So there's a lot of work that needs to happen. But by far the lending and borrowing, like I was thinking about like payday loans, right? Payday loans are insanely high APYs in the real world, right? Guy gets his paycheck on Friday. He needs money on Wednesday. He gets $700 for his $800 paycheck. You know, applications like that within the crypto world, if that guy was getting paid in like USDC on the Ethereum network in a smart contract, there's no reason why someone couldn't like set up a, you know, a pool that was providing that person liquidity. But again, like, that's when this stuff will really get traction. When you can take what's happening in crypto and some dude working at Walmart can get a payday loan from it and have no idea what a Bitcoin is. And that's where this needs to go for it to happen.
Yeah, all this middleman stuff. To me, that's like the best case, is to get rid of all these middleman people.
Oh, yeah. Fees. I mean, everyone likes that idea. Everyone loves that idea.
Okay. We have a lot of listener questions here. The people have a lot of questions for you. Very popular, Mr. Strasser. First from A. Raven. Many of you know him from the DFS streets, I'm sure. He sent in a half-joking question, I think. He says, how can you, or he means I, how can I stop thinking about being the only person to lose in the market last year while everyone else drug their knuckles through the dirt and aped their way to historic gains? These ape hands were closer to the ground than Bales' chest, where I also was the only one to lose, a reference, of course, to the push-up bet. And what do you say to people who actually lost in the last year? Is it even possible to lose in the last year? How can you live with yourself anymore?
Don't sweat it. Like, do you know how many... I could go back to this morning and like come up with like 10 regrets I made for the day. When I was in college, freshman year, there's a kid across the hall who, he was an offensive lineman for Duke football, and Duke football was garbage. They lost every game, I think, the season before I got there. And they won, I think, one game my freshman year. And this guy was like a bench player. I think he was a fifth year senior. He played a little bit in his fourth and fifth year. And I ran into him at the 5-year reunion, and he was like, hey man, I'm starting a software company. And I was like, all right, cool. And I don't mean to be rude, but like, I had a lot of friends at Duke that were like, if they said something like that, I like had my checkbook out. I was like, cause I had money back then from poker. I literally would just have my, like, okay, what do you need? Like, like, I mean, and this kid, Zach, I didn't react like that. And I wasn't mean or anything, but I like blew it off. And I was like, okay, so what are you creating? And he was basically like, yeah, you know, like the way that the athletes get all their, diet information, training schedule, when we go to tournaments, filling all the stuff out. Anyway, fast forward today, the company is worth, I think, a few hundred million dollars. Every single program in NCAA and professional uses this program. It's like it's the gold standard for any athletic program out there. Every single one of them, the way they commute with their recruits, with their trainees, it's all this kid Zach. He's got a few hundred employees. Wow. So yeah, I mean, like A. Raven, like I have like a lifetime of stories where I could have been super rich, and like you just got to move on, bro. Just
it's in the past. We're moving on. This is a forward thinking.
Past.
This is a forward thinking show. Okay. From Josh, he says, "How has working in finance/trading changed or formed Jason's worldview?" He says, "I covered markets for a number of years, and for me, it shed light on how many supposedly smart and powerful people are actually fish, either through ignorance or lack of courage to take a stand because it would hurt them." I guess he was in the industry covering it for a newspaper or whatever, I don't know. And he emerged with a poor worldview. How has working in the industry affected your worldview of the finance industry?
There are a lot of bad actors, especially with social media. There's a lot of people out there that are phony at worst or have bad intentions. But I think it's the same thing true in your DFS streets. I'm sure in the sports betting streets, we know there's a lot of that bullshit. I think every industry, poker for sure, there's always going to be bad apples. I think the finance industry is really interesting, especially the trading, because every day is new. And I think when you look for a job, all you can ask for is variety. Like the worst thing about a job is doing the same thing every day. And like, yeah, like look at the last year of the markets. Like it's just complete insanity, no playbook, no nothing. So I don't know. For me personally, finding a job where like every day is fun is hard. It's really hard because the real world like really sucks. Like most things in the real world are just total trash. And so I totally get what that person is saying. And we can go talk shit about lots of people that are high and mighty finance people that are full of it. But at the end of the day, like I really enjoy it and it's a really fun day today. And there aren't many things that I could see myself doing this like all out.
Yeah. You mentioned that your office is in on Top Shots. You're in the punk streets, you're in the DeFi streets. I mean, isn't this distracting when you're managing? I don't know how much you're managing, but some outrageous amount of money. Isn't all this stuff distracting?
Not really, because from 8:30 to 3, I basically don't leave my desk. I might as well pee in a cup. I'm like sitting there. I eat lunch, like, room typing. It's like as close as it gets to like being in a sports competition in front of your computer. I'm like all in when the markets are open. But yeah, like now on Saturday and Sunday, I get to like claim my DeFi rewards and figure out if I'm going to sell them or keep these shit coins. And yeah, it's fun, but it's honestly like buying pieces of Three Punks and doing DeFi on the weekend doesn't distract me from what I'm
doing. Yeah, so you're better than me. I'm supposed to be doing X and I'm like refreshing the poodle price and you know, I'm looking at Uniswap and stuff like that. You know, I get so distracted.
You got way the too bug easy. Harder than I do. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Okay. From Sahil sent in another joke. Sounds like maybe one of your friends. He said, when is he converting the fund to an NFT trading operation? You know, it's funny because I had Michael Levy on, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he, you know, is involved in some investment firm for his family and stuff. And he just says all he gets now is people asking him, start an NFT fund. I want to give you money to go out and invest in NFTs. I mean, do people ask you for this? I know obviously you're not going to do it, but are people being like, Jason, take my money and go in, but not in the market, go invest in some weird fucking shit?
No. Everyone is just like, hey, dude, stare at the computer, trade options, pee in a cup, and don't do anything else. That's what they tell me to do. So I think, unfortunately, what happens is when you become like a specialist, all I've done my entire career, I'm 36. All I've done since I was 21 is trade options. Like, people like get scared. If I even mentioned, like, some of my investors know I bought a punk. Like, if I told some investors, they look at me like I'm an idiot, like the way my wife looked at me. But yeah, I mean, yeah, unfortunately, people only want me to do what they think I'm good at. And they're probably right.
Our own Drew Dinkmeyer had a question. The Dink Goat himself, grinding really hard in the hoop streets. He said Strasser had a tweet a few weeks back about a market that is predominantly passively managed and the downside implications for investors. My question for his tweet is that why normal market behavior wouldn't correct that issue over time. For example, the move to passive management has come because active managers haven't been able to deliver returns worth their fees. So yeah, do you want to expand a little bit on the tweet that you had about active versus passive management?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, I think. We're in a world right now where I think 40% of everything is passive. If you just think about that, it's remarkable. So take GameStop. GameStop goes from 10 to 300, right? We're going to find out because the filings will come out in April, but I'm sure what you're going to see, every single professional investor that was active or paying attention sold. Like, if you had a thesis on why to own GameStop at 10 and it goes to 300, like, and you're paying attention, you sold, right? Who didn't sell, right? All the passive, right? So the passive funds, like, it just goes up and they just, and when money comes in, they actually need to buy like more now as a percent. So it's we're in a world where 40% is like that. And the point I'm trying to make is that I agree completely with Drew. Like, active managers have not earned their fees at all as a whole. That being said, at some point we're getting to a tipping point extreme, and it's become very mainstream where you just invest in, especially our generation. Like, do you spend any time looking for active mutual fund managers? I bet the answer is no, right? Right? Nobody does, right? They just put it in like, well, maybe you put it in one of these Dave Portnoy ETFs. So pretty much everyone's putting it in just SPY or QQQ or some passively managed right. thing. We're getting to a world though, imagine a world where 80% or 70% are not paying attention. Where GameStop goes to 300 and 70% of people are just like, whatever, I don't care. I'm not selling. That's not what I do. And you're going to start to see like much more weird moves in stocks and less predictable markets. Because you remember, you know, economic theory, right? A stock goes up, people that own it are like more likely to sell. That's how it works, right? But that's not how it works with the index. It goes up and they're actually buying more. Mm-hmm. So what he said is, it makes sense, but I don't know. Like, I just feel like the thing I'm worried about is what people should be doing is thinking about what active manager should I invest in? Let me spend the time, or let me find someone else to find the time to find good active managers to invest in. And I'm not just saying that because I'm an active manager, but at some point, just rational people have to think that just blindly buying stocks, if 70% of people are doing that, there's going to be a lot of opportunities to pay attention. You want to be in the fund that sold GameStop, not in the fund that wrote it up and just wrote it back down. And so, yeah, I do think what he says is correct. If you start seeing passive do really badly compared to active, you will see money flip over. So he's right. There is going to be some natural pulls to passive, but we haven't seen it yet. And passive has just been this monster where people, you know, people just keep adding to it. So, you know, as long as the money keeps flowing in, it's very likely to outperform. So I think what, if you really wanted to be tactical, you'd have to wait for money to stop flowing in or flowing in differently. That's why I like Cathy Wood ARK Investments. Like, I'm not a big fan of like what she's actually buying, but I'm a big fan of people like her getting a following with normal people. She pays attention. Every day you can look at what she's doing. She's rebalancing her portfolio. She's looking to see what went up. Where's it? Where's their value? And like, I think people can appreciate like, all right, like I'm paying her to do that. If Cathy Wood owned GameStop, she would have sold GameStop. And, you know, there's value there.
I mean, it's like any industry, right? Like you're paying someone for a service. A lot of people are going to be awful at it. If I'm paying someone to paint my house, there's going to be a lot of people. It's our job in theory to find the people that are actually good at it. So if somebody's charging me $2 and $20, I better go out and find somebody who's really good at it. I mean,
and there was a lot of just garbage going on in my industry and in the active mutual fund space, huge fees, horrible performance. So no one's crying for any of these people, but, you know, fees have come way down in my world and they've come way down in active management and they're and every year they're coming down. They come down every year. So like in 3 or 4 years from now, when you see passive go 50, you see passive go 60, if that happens, it's been growing at like 3% a year or whatever. Like people should have a plan for that and should probably be like, all right, like I need to find some humans to sell GameStop if that happens.
Yeah. Got a question from James, which I think probably a lot of people are interested in. He says, do you think moving forward, this will be a healthy or unhealthy welcoming to markets for this large swath of young traders? Is this finally the moment in time where they don't need a firm or a job and can do it on their own, right? And this is basically getting into the whole idea of all these people entered in like in this outrageous bull market. And my concern for people is that they think this is how it is forever. I'm a genius now. I'm a stock savant because I threw a bunch of letters together and I'm printing right now. My concern is that people are going to think that they can just blast off and do this forever. I also have a bunch of friends who, you know, they're only literally they got into the stock market in March or whatever, last March. They're literally have only seen gains. So like market goes down like 1% in a day. They're like, what the fuck? I'm selling everything. This is awful. You know what I mean? And so I think there's definitely some danger there. But yeah, what do you say to the people who want to take more time to do this on their own and try to actually grind this stuff?
I think you have to be like honest with yourself intellectually. Like it's the same thing in poker or DFS when someone gets really hot out the gate, like when they first start. Like there's a certain person that gets really hot out the gate and is like, you know what? I'm running hot right now. I need to like make sure I need to keep improving and make sure my strategy is good. Ryan Doubt, you know, he's a name, right? He seems like a really nice guy. He got real hot. He won a poker tournament early in his career. And you could tell he was the kind of guy. He won the poker tournament, but he wasn't just like spewing off all his money in like the highest stakes games, right? He still was working on his craft. He knew he had a big bing really early on, but he wasn't like going nuts. A lot of these traders, like the ego's out of control and they're just not self-aware. And those people will get a reckoning at some point. I mean, that's just how things work. I just hope that there are traders that are just not, that are doing more than buying stocks. Like they have a system in place and that are committed to it. And then when stocks don't go up, I don't know how to say it. Like you're just really stupid if you like just think this is how it's going to be forever. Yeah. It's not. So like if you can't understand that and you don't have the ability to like look past the market past last March and you don't have any respect for like the history, it's just unfortunate. But I do think a lot of people who have gotten into markets recently do understand that dynamic. They're skeptical of the market going up forever and they're trying to come up with strategies that'll work in both markets, you know, all kinds of markets, I should say. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's pretty reckless just if you bought a bunch of stocks and got lucky to quit your job and think you're got something.
Sure. Okay, from Powell, he says, under what circumstances does it make sense for a layperson to start learning options or is it going to be overwhelmingly negative EV space for them? I think we covered this last time a bit and you gave people a big warning on options. Any advice for Powell?
Sure. Options are a very useful tool. say Adam's got a bunch of DraftKings stock, right? And he wants to hold on to it, but he wants to hedge his risk. You can pay like the most minuscule VIG of all time compared to like sports betting or whatever, and have your risk where you want it. You can be like, all right, you know, I'm going to buy a 50 strike put. So if DraftKings goes to 20 tomorrow, I know I can at least sell it for 50. That's like you using options to have risk that you want. That's a win. You know, if you're an airline and you're worried crude oil is going to, or jet fuel is going to go up too much, you can buy an option on jet fuel. And yeah, maybe you're slightly negative VIG you're paying, but the VIG is so small compared to the risk that you want, and it makes sense for you. That's a good way to use options. If you want to be like an options professional where you're trying to like buy options that are cheaper than where they should be and sell them where they're more expensive than they should be, that's a hard game to get into. And it requires a lot of work. And most people, and the tools available on the internet are garbage. That's the one thing. We're in a world where everyone teaches themselves everything on the internet. In this world, for some reason, like poker's awesome, DFS is awesome. You got all this great content out there. There's just nothing like that for finance. It's garbage. So yeah, I just encourage people like use options if you want to use them because they make sense for your risk profile. To be like, yeah, I'm an options pro. I'm going to buy this shit. By the way, Citadel's selling them to you. So you got to feel like, and Susquehanna is selling them to you. So right away, like understand when you go and you buy them, who's selling them to you, right? So unless you really feel like you have something where you can outsmart those people, just use them when they make sense for you for risk reasons. Don't pretend like you can like generate an edge with them.
Well, one thing we learned today is that if you want to be an options trader, you need to piss in a cup. You're not allowed to leave your computer, and you have to piss in a cup because you're not allowed to leave your desk at any time from 8 to 3:30.
Yeah, 8:30 to 3. Yeah, it's pretty intense, yeah.
All right, last question we're going to do today comes from Jason, another Jason. He says, do you still play poker? How often? What stakes? Do you think you're a favorite? I mean, I miss playing live poker, man. I mean, playing live poker, playing like, you know, like higher stakes for whatever your role is, cash is fun. Being deep in a tournament is fun. I think live poker is still fun. I don't think I'd want to play as much as I used to play anymore. But yeah, what are your thoughts on poker these days?
I miss it so bad. I feel like it got taken away from me, you know? It's like, I don't know how to describe it. Like I didn't play a lot, maybe like 5 to 7 tournaments a year. And then like some cash games locally. I really miss it. Where my ability is at is a funny question. I think like in a casino, I would win at like 5-10, no limit, maybe lower than that.
Come on. Of course you would stop it. Stop. if you're not beating 5-10 at the local casino, I you shouldn't be managing any money.
Well, I'm talking about like you walk into the Bellagio. There used to be like a 20-40 no limit game going. Yeah. And there were some good players that used to play that back in the day. I would presumably like, I used to win at those stakes definitely back in the day, but and higher than that. But I don't know. I mean, I don't have a great feel. Live poker is pretty soft in general. Live tournaments, I don't play the super high roller stuff or whatever, you know, but any live tournament I play in, I gotta figure I'm a favorite and the numbers are pretty good for me.
What was discouraging to me about poker, and I had Doug Polk on like, you know, a month or two ago, is where it's gotten online with, you know, I mean, what Doug was doing to win at that level
is just
insane, right? And so like, I'm like, you know, one of the things about watching the Doug Daniel match and hearing Doug talk about it was just like, I don't even want to play online anymore. Like, I'm just like, I know I'm just like drawing dead. You know what I mean? And I think that's,
you know, when I see those videos, and I didn't watch your interview with him, but I've seen a lot of stuff he said where he discussing his sort of preparation for this type of thing. And back in the day, he played Solsky heads up, and Solsky is one of the great poker minds, and he played him and beat him heads up. Doug is self-admittedly like not the smartest dude in the world. And I am not even close to where Doug is, in my opinion. I think he's got a great mind. And, but that guy works, man. Like if anyone, the takeaway from that challenge should be like, this dude freaking works, man. He grinds. He's a grinder. He's in there real deep. He's not just like running these sims. He's like really trying to find patterns and exploits. And then he plays, and then sometimes he plays on stream, and like, I'm very impressed with that guy. You know, it's pretty cool. I mean, the heads up poker is a little bit easier to analyze than other forms of poker, you know, but man, yeah. I used to play Heads Up No Limit, and I can tell you that I don't think I would be, you know, 25 cent, 50 cent online right now. That's how insane it's gotten. But yeah, like what Doug does with poker, I try to take that same approach with what I do, try to take that type of analysis. And that's what everyone, like, to compete at a high level, that's what it looks like. It's not that sexy what Doug is doing. He's just a grinder.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's, yeah, for sure. An incredible amount of work. Okay. We've taken up enough of Jason's time here tonight on Wednesday. Jason, tell the people where they can find you if you want to be found. I don't know if you want to be found or what, but tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah, man. I got a bump last time I was on here on Twitter, at Strassa2 on Twitter. My DMs are open. I think last time I said that I got like 30 of them, but I answered all of them. So if you guys have any questions about finance, or I don't think anyone cares about my crypto DeFi takes, but anything, just shoot me a message. I'd love to help out.
Yeah. Shill him your punks, or your fraction.
I think my bags are full right now, but like I might be reloading. There's a downtick going on. So if we get a real downtick, I'm going to be reloading.
All right. Thanks so much, Jason. Learned a lot tonight. Be back next week with Evan for more football talk. For producer Luke, for Jason, I am Adam. Good luck, everybody.